Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, Minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Zion, the 12th Hour in Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is October 18, 2016, or April 18, 2020, we will start our first service today with a song entitled, Wonderful Peace. Far away in the depths of my spirit tonight rose a melody sweeter than sound. In celestial like strain it unceasingly falls, for my soul like an infinite calm. Peace, peace, wonderful peace, coming down from the Father above. Sweep over my spirit forever, I pray, in fathomless billows of love. What a treasure I have in this wonderful peace, buried deep in the heart of my soul. So secure that no power can mine it away, while the years of eternity roam. Peace, peace, wonderful peace, coming down from the Father above. Sweep over my spirit forever, I pray, in phantomless billows of love. I am resting tonight on this wonderful peace, resting sweetly in Yahshua's control. For I'm kept from all danger by night and by day, and His glory is flooding my soul. Peace, peace, wonderful peace, coming down from the Father above. Sweep over my spirit forever, I pray, in phantomless billows of love. And methinks when I rise to that city of peace, where the author of peace I shall see, that one strain of the song which the ransom will sing, in the heavenly kingdom will be. Peace, peace, wonderful peace, coming down from the Father above. Sweep over my spirit forever, I pray, in phantomless billows of love. Also, are you here without comfort or rest, marching down through the rough pathway of time? May Yahshua, your friend, near the shadows grow dark. Oh, accept of this peace so sublime. Peace, peace, wonderful peace, coming down from the Father above. Sweep over my spirit forever, I pray, in phantomless billows of love.
Ushering in the everlasting kingdom.
His everlasting kingdom. So the title should be Ushering In of His Everlasting Kingdom. We're going to start with Shepherd Rod, Volume 1. We're on page 135. We're going to start with Isaiah 54. We're going to go through 66, 13 chapters. And we're going to introduce once again to the world what the prophecies have to say about the judgment of the living. And so Isaiah had that prophecy, and he started in Isaiah 54, and that was revealed to the Adventists in the book by M. L. Andreessen in 1928 and 29, when he was shown this message, and he wrote the three little books of Isaiah, the Gospel Prophet, and the Adventists published it in their quarters of 1929, and three parts, and they knew they had a new message, and but they didn't know that it was actually announcing the judgment of the living. So the Adventists are without excuse. So we're going to read to you. Actually, we need to get the book, Isaiah the Gospel Prophet, by M. L. Andreessen, and see his comments on what he had to say about whenever it was given to him, the prophecy. He was a Seventh-day Adventist minister in high standing in the Adventist church at that time. M. L. Andreessen. Part 1. Page 135, Shepherd Rod. And I want to say that the Volume 3 of M. L. Andreessen, Isaiah the Gospel Prophet, deals with Isaiah 54 through the rest of the book. But we're going to do V.T. Holliff, Shepherd Rod, Volume 1, starting on 135. And then when we get through with that, no doubt we'll deal with Isaiah the Gospel Prophet by M. L. Andreessen as well. Probably the whole book, starting with chapter 1. It says, this call for reformation. Now remember, I told you I was in Shepherd Rod, Volume 1. And it says, this call for reformation as set forth here in the direct is the direct result of the study of the 13 chapters in the book of Isaiah as devised by the Seventh-day Adventist denomination and presented unto the churches in the entire organization throughout the world. These lessons were taught in the Sabbath School Department during January, February, and March of the year 1929, and beginning with the 54th chapter, ended with the 66th chapter. We believe the hand of Yahweh was leading, and that these particular lessons came at an appointed time by the divine direction with the intention to arouse His people to action from the lukewarm lead of sin, a condition, and spiritual feebleness. In Volume 3, page 492, we read, General Conference, which is the highest authority that Elohim has upon the earth, General Conference spoken of here is not one man's opinion, but a general conference of brethren assembled from all parts of the world, as described in Gospel Workers, page 489. But when in a general conference the judgment of brethren assembled from all parts of the field is exercised, private independence and private judgment must not be stubbornly maintained, but surrendered. For this reason, Yahweh honored the General Conference and sent the lessons through that channel with the intention to bring forth a reformation in the entire denomination of the Seventh-day Adventist in one single quarter of Sabbath school studies. These are 13 chapters of Isaiah, or one continuous letter written for the church. Though they have been in the Bible for many centuries, they were intended for us at this present time and stand as a direct epistle to the church now. The 54th chapter is the beginning of the letter, and it ends with the 66th chapter. For the following reasons are given for believing thus. Saying, O barren, Isaiah 54, start with verse 1, that thou that didst not bear, break forth into singing, and aloud, thou that didst not travail with child, for more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Yahweh, saith the Yahshua. Isaiah 54:1. Chapter 4 of Galatians says the woman spoken of here, the barren, she who travail not with child, desolate is Sarah. The other called the married wife is Agar. Sarah is desolate because she stepped aside and gave her husband to Agar. Thus Agar is the married wife. Sarah was barren, without child, while Agar had Ishmael. For it is written, Rejoice, thou barren that bearest not. Break forth and cry, thou that travailest not. For the desolate hath many more children than she which hath an husband. Galatians 4:27. Galatians 4:25. Says Agar, represents the Old Testament church, or Jerusalem in Palestine. For this Agar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, an answer to Jerusalem, which now is and is in bondage with her children. But Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. Galatians 4:26-31. Thus Sarah, the free, is a symbol of Jerusalem, which is above, or the church of the New Testament. Now keep in mind that M. L. Andreessen, a Seventh-day Adventist minister, this message was given to him, and he introduced it to his brethren. Now, V.T. Holliff is a Sabbath school teacher in the Adventist church as well at that time. He was a teacher, and he picked up on these lesson studies in the Quarterly of 1929, and that's why he is here now doing a commentary in the Shepherd's Rod, because he already chose him to interpret what M. L. Andreessen, the Seventh-day Adventist, had put forth. And then Yahweh raised up another Seventh-day Adventist, V.T. Holliff, to interpret what M. L. Andreessen had put forth. Okay, had supplied for him. So this is all done within the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But keep in mind that Yahweh chooses people of the laity out of the midst of the brethren. And M. N. Andreessen, he was the minister, though. So he would be a prophet figure that was raised up in the midst of his brethren to break this here information to. And then V.T. Holliff was a layman, a Sabbath school teacher. He wasn't an Adventist minister, so that makes him a layman. So he picks up and interprets what the prophet had written in the Adventist church. All right, let's go ahead now. Ishmael represents the children of the Old Testament church, but Isaac, the children of the New Testament church. The New Testament Apostolic Church. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of the promise.
So this is M.N. Andreessen telling the Seventh-day Adventists, we brethren. Now we brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of the promise. But as then he that was born after flesh persecuted him that was born after spirit, even so it is now. Galatians 4:28-29. So, the Adventists have been persecuting the Seventh-day Adventist laity and their ministers that stayed with Ellen G. White after the 1888 debacle at Minneapolis, where Jones and Wagner, Yahweh raised those two messengers up with a new message for the Adventists as a test to them. And they were ministers that accepted it, that stayed with Ellen G. White's opinion on the message, and there were a lot of the laity, a lot of the members of the church that stayed with it. And so therefore, that's the Seventh-day Adventist General Conference, and they persecuted Ellen G. White, and they persecuted all of her followers that stayed with her and Jones and Wagner. They persecuted Jones and Wagner, where both of them left the Seventh-day Adventist Church between the year of 1900 and 1910. Both Jones and Wagner had left the Adventist Church because they were so persecuted. So here in 1929, the Adventists representing Agar, now keep this in mind, and representing the 10 tribes of Israel, keep that in mind, the General Conference, representing the 10 tribes of Israel. Now keep in mind, I've got some new light unfolding here. Not only do they represent the 10 tribes of Israel, but those grizzled horses that were the second team attached to that chariot of the Adventist, they're in the Zechariah 6 prophecy, where that fourth chariot had a double leadership of horses depicted there, the grizzle and the bay. Well, the grizzle represented the Seventh-day Adventist General Conference leadership, and it represented the 10 tribes. Those grizzle horses represented the 10 tribes. And the 10 tribes was in charge of the chariot. Now, the bay horse leadership that was connected first to the chariot, which would be represented by Ellen G. White and her followers, they represented the bay horses. So, you had, and also Ellen G. White and her followers represented the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, those two tribes. Get it? So the bay horses represented the leadership of Judah and Benjamin, whereas the grizzled horses represented the leadership of the 10 tribes. And the 10 tribes are represented as Ellen G. White was shown through inspiration that the Adventists, according to Ezekiel's chapter 4 prophecy, of laying on his left side for right side for 390 days, or left side, I mean, for 390 days, and that 390 days a day for a year ended in 1890 at the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists, fulfilling that prophecy, Ezekiel 4, where that prophecy was up. And it showed that the grizzled horse team then, they showed up. They showed up in 1890 in the form of the General Conference, taking over the Seventh-day Adventist Church completely. Up until 1890, the General Conference didn't have full control of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. But after 1890, they took full control, and then they persecuted the Adventist laity, the bay horses. They persecuted them for 40 years, from 1890 to 1930. Okay. As Abraham did, we'll continue our reading here. We're on page 136. As Abraham did, cast out the bondwoman Hagar and her son Ishmael, just so Yahweh did cast out the Old Testament church or Jerusalem, which now is, Galatians 4:30. Nevertheless, what saith the Scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So, the Adventist church then, they continued on as the leaders of the whole body of the Seventh-day Adventists, by being empowered and representing those grizzled horses, team, they were in control of the bay horses, and they could only be in charge of the bay horses as long as they were connected to that chariot. So when did the disconnection take place? It took place in 2002 at Kermit, Texas, when the grizzly horses was cut loose from the bay horse team, and now that chariot has got one single purebred horses that are leading that team, and that is the House of David, the everlasting kingdom of David, the everlasting kingdom of heaven, the everlasting kingdom of his son Yahshua. That represents these bay horses now, because they're free to sit up to the everlasting kingdom of heaven. The scripture makes the subject too plain to be misunderstood. Sarah is a symbol of the apostolic congregation and Hagar of the Old Testament Jewish congregation. At the cross is represented by the Pharisees, Sadducees. So, as it showed up again, this two churches showed up again in the Adventist movement from 1844 in the form of this double leadership in the church, the Grizzle and the Bay Horses. And we had the Grizzle representing Hagar, the Old Testament church, and we had the bay horses representing Sarah, the New Testament church, the seed of Isaac. I mean, Isaac then. So, there you have it. Turning to the 54th chapter of Isaiah, it will be noticed that this chapter is addressed to the barren, childless, desolate woman, Sarah, who is a symbol of the apostolic congregation that came forth at the Yeshua's resurrection 2,000 years ago to start the New Testament, to set the foundation for the New Testament covenant with the apostles. Spirit of Prophecy, commenting on this chapter, says the prophecy is for the gospel church at this time. We read in Prophecy in Kings, page 374, 375. Looking on still farther through the ages, the prophet beheld the literal fulfillment of these glorious promises. He saw the bearers of the glad tidings of salvation going unto the ends of the earth, unto every kindred and people. He heard the Yeshua saying of the gospel church, "Behold, I will extend peace unto her like a river, and the glory of the Gentiles like a flowing stream." And he heard the commission. Well, apparently it's not quite time for the Gentiles to come forth yet. I've been testing the waters on this out here in my community. I've been visiting them now for the last 2 years. And the Methodists and the Baptists, mostly. And they're not ready to let the Gentiles go yet. Their leaders are not ready. But when the time comes for it, they will come like a flowing stream. Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitation. Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes, for thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles. So we know that we're going to inherit the Gentiles right where the kingdom is set up starting, and that's here in Liberty Hill, Texas. For the Yahweh declared unto the prophet that he would send his witnesses into the nations, unto Tarshish, Tola, to Tubal, and Ivan, to the Isles of Saul. For the prophet heard the voice of Elohim calling his congregation unto her appointed work, that the way might be prepared for the ushering in of his everlasting kingdom. Now this is the title of our new series, Ushering In of His Everlasting Kingdom, Part 1. So it says that, for the prophecy could not have been for the early part of the apostolic congregation, made up of the disciples. For we read in Isaiah 54:17, no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. Okay, now, with the judgment we know was set in 1844, starts the judgment of the dead. So from that time on, that's where this prophecy applies. If this scripture had a reference unto the early part of the congregation of prior unto the Dark Ages, then Elohim would have failed to carry out his promise. Note that from the beginning of the apostolic congregation, the stones, swords, crosses, ropes, fires, and many other cruel instruments which are formed against the church did prosper, and continue to prosper up till about the middle of the 18th century. Therefore, the prophet could have had no reference to the early part of the congregation. For the following quotation will prove the time unto which the scriptures apply. Whosoever shall gather together against thee shall fall for thy sake. No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. Clad in the armor of Yahshua's righteousness, the church is to enter upon her final conflict. Fair as the moon, pure as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners. For the darkest hour of the church's struggle with the powers of evil is that which immediately precedes the day of her final deliverance. But none who trust in the Yahweh need fear. For when the blast of the terrible one is as a storm against the wall, Elohim will be unto his church a refuge from the storm. Prophecy in Kings, page 725. Again, we read in early writings, page 384-385. As the saints left the cities and villages, they were pursued by the wicked who sought to slay them. But the swords that were raised to kill Yahweh's people broke and fell as powerless as a straw. Angels of the Yahweh shielded the saints. As they cried day and night for deliverance, their cry came up before the Yahweh. Thus we have proof that the chapter was written for the people of Yahweh who shall live at the time of the end. For the intention in this article is not to explain all this, that the chapter contains, but to point out the time it's intended for, with a few instructive remarks. In another study, we may take all these chapters separate of each other, verse by verse. Isaiah 54:14-15. There is great encouragement for the people of Yahweh, and it ought to strengthen our faith. In righteousness shalt thou be established, thou shalt be afar from oppression, for they shall surely gather together, but not by me. Whosoever shall gather together against thee shall fall for thy sake. The time of the fulfillment of these verses is well portrayed in early writings, pages 282-283. I saw the saints leaving the cities and villages and associating together in company and living in the most solitary places. Angels provided them food and water while the wicked were suffering from hunger and thirst. Then I saw the leading men of the earth consulting together, and Satan and his angel busy around them. I saw a writing, copies of which were scattered in different parts of the land, giving orders that unless the saints should yield their peculiar faith, give up the Sabbath, and observe the first day of the week, the people were at liberty after a certain time to put them to death. The angels, in the form of men of war, fought for them. Satan wished to have the privilege of destroying the saints of the Most High, but Yahshua bade his angels watch over them. Next came the multitude of the angry wicked, and next a mass of evil angels, hurrying on the wicked to slay the saints. But before they could approach Elohim's people, the wicked must first pass this company of mighty holy angels. This was impossible, for the angels of the Yahweh were causing them to recede, and also causing the evil angels who were pressing around them to fall back. Isaiah 54:11-12 contain another wonderful promise and shows the purity and holiness of Yahweh's people. O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest and not comforted, behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colors, and lay thy foundation with sapphires, and will make thy windows of agate, and thy gates of carbuncle, and all thy borders of pleasant stone. This scripture should hardly refer to the New Testament. Could hardly refer to the New Testament, for the holy city, for there is no reference made of the walls of the city having windows, nor could there be any necessity for them, for 12 gates only are mentioned. Furthermore, the gates are made of one great pearl, and not of carbuncle, and the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Every several gate was of one pearl. Revelation 21:21. For the verses being considered at this time refer unto a spiritual house of which Solomon's temple was a symbol. This spiritual house is referred to by Paul in Ephesians 2:20-22, and are built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Yahshua Messiah himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together groweth unto an holy temple, and the Yahshua, in whom you also are builded together for an habitation of the Father through the Spirit. Note that this spiritual house has foundations, windows, gates, and borders, enclosures. The foundations refer to the apostles, Yahshua himself being the chief cornerstone, see Ephesians 2:20. For the windows of the house are used to give light. This has reference to the prophets who foresee things in advance and give the light upon the subject, as in 1 Samuel 9:9. Okay, it says, before time in Israel, when a man went to inquire of Yahweh, thus he spake, come and let us go unto the seer. For he that is now called a prophet was before time called a seer. The gates of a house serve the purpose to let in those who have the right and to keep out all others. This could have no other meaning than the watchman on the walls of Zion. The ministry. for the borders or enclosures mean the church members the timely stone. 1 Peter 2:5. He also is lively stones are built up his spiritual house and holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable unto Yahweh by the Yahshua Messiah. Note the kind and quality of material used here in this spiritual house. It is the most precious known unto humanity. I will lay thy stones with fair colors, Isaiah 54:11. Foundations of sapphires, windows of agate, gates of carbuncle, and borders of precious stone. Think of Yahshua as the precious cornerstone. The apostle who sacrificed their lives as a wonderful foundation. The prophets, many of whom were killed by the cruelty, even the extent of being sawed between two logs. As the windows to give light unto this beautiful house and those in the church during the Dark Ages who suffered and were tortured by the cruel persecutors, to beautify the borders of this most glorious spiritual house. If each one asked himself, am I fitted to be used in this spiritual structure whose stones are of fair colors? Am I willing to trust in Yahweh and suffer for Him, whatever He may permit for my good? Or do I want the world and heaven too? Can we serve Yahweh and Mammon? Can we in any way disregard the instructions given unto us by the Spirit of Yahweh and expect to be fitted among those who would rather die than disobey in the smallest of His commands? How fearful, he thought, can the church supplant the instructions of Yahweh with wise plans of men? Yahweh calls to return the word that transforms, Isaiah chapter 55. Ho, everyone that thirsteth, come ye to the waters. And he that hath no money, come ye buy and eat. Yea, come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Wherefore do ye spend money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat that ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. Isaiah 55:1-2. The word ho signifies whosoever or anyone that will hear. It was not so in the Old Testament time, for the Jew then thought the Bible was for the descendants of Abraham only. Come ye unto the waters, and he that hath no money. Water is the most essential article to sustain life, both human, animal, and vegetable. It is the most abundant substance, and without it, life is impossible. In this verse, it is meant to represent spiritual life, which is bounded by eternity. Yahshua, speaking unto the woman at the well, said, whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. John 4:14. Water is composed of two elements, namely oxygen and hydrogen. Without hydrogen, life cannot exist. Without oxygen, life would cease in less than 15 minutes. Water is never sold, it is free. The price we pay in the cities is not for the water, but for the service rendered in bringing this necessity unto us for our daily use. Neither is it for sale in the Scriptures, but is offered free. No price can be set for life eternal. If it were so, no one could buy it. Therefore, the symbol used here is perfect. It would be impossible to substitute any other earthly article to represent spiritual life. Yea, come, buy wine and money without
buy wine and milk without money and without price. And though the water is free, the wine and the milk are sold, but there is no set price on it, nor is the exchange made with money. Something must be given in trade to make the transaction. What must it be? The answer is found in the 7th verse as follows. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto the Yahweh, and he will have mercy upon him, and unto our Elohim, for he will abundantly pardon. We must forsake our ways and our thoughts, and in exchange, take Elohim's thoughts and follow his ways, Isaiah 55:8. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Yahweh. Not until after the transaction is made can one please serve or understand Yahweh, nor can he enter heaven. When this transaction is made, the thoughts, ways, desires, actions, and the whole human being is exchanged. How do we get Elohim's thoughts? Only in one way may they be attained. Elohim's thoughts and ways are found in his word, the Bible. The man who will follow the complete instructions by the Spirit of Yahweh is in a heavenly atmosphere and walks with Yahweh as Enoch of old. And we know that Enoch walked with Yahweh for 300 years. Actually, 365 years. But after his first son was born, Enoch's son, he walked with Yahweh 300 years. That's what the scripture says. What is the wine and the milk? We shall first speak of the wine. While the water is rich in oxygen, the wine is rich in iron. With the absence of iron in the system, oxygen would be of no essential value unto the human body. For iron is the train by which oxygen is transported throughout the human anatomy. As soon as oxygen enters into the lungs, the agencies of iron takes the element and carries it through the entire system. Thus, whatsoever the wine represents, without it, the water life would be of no importance, as well as the water without the wine as symbol would be altogether useless. The wine represents the blood of Yahshua, therefore the wine is used in connection with the Yahshua supper, a symbol of the spilled blood of Yahshua. If you must have life eternal water, you must also have the blood of Yahshua, the wine, for one would be of no value without the other. Again, we see that no other earthly article, substance, or element could be used to represent the blood of the Yahshua. The next symbol mentioned is the milk, and it too must be perfect in itself in order to point out the truth intended by the Spirit of Yahweh. The human body is made up of 16 different elements. If we should exalt our supply of one of these elements, and life did not cease immediately depending on the element that lacking, there would be trouble somewhere within the human system. If milk contained all the elements required to keep the human body, the meaning of the symbol would indicate that the first two symbols or doctrines are of no greater importance. Since milk does not contain all the necessary elements, it signifies that the doctrine represented by the milk only is not sufficient, for the element of iron is absent from the milk. Though a trace of iron is found in the milk, it is so infinitesimal that it may be expressed in the following language. The amount of iron found in the 10 gallons of milk to be put in the corner of one's eye. That which is not found in the milk is supplied by the wine. Therefore, the three doctrines taught here cannot be separated one from the other. What is the doctrine taught by the milk? This symbol is simply to understand the milk represents the word of the Father as found in the Bible. 1 Peter 2:2. As newborn babes, desire the sincere milk of the word that ye may grow thereby. Elohim's word is perfect, and it will supply all the doctrines, elements needed for the human heart to make us perfect, but without the shedding of the blood of Yahshua, it would not profit us at all. Neither would the word and the blood help us much if there was no life in the Son of Elohim. Thus, the water, wine, and milk are combined and cannot be separated one from another and still maintain life eternal. Perfect symbols, are they not? Suppose you would add an element to the milk. Would it not be a strange one? And if it be a strange one to the milk, would it be foreign to the human system? If this be true, we must conclude it would be poison to the human body. But you say, suppose I add the element of iron, it would not then be poison. By adding another element, it would put the milk out of balance, and it would be milk no longer. It is impossible for human wisdom to improve on Yahweh's work. Just so it is impossible for us to neglect one of Elohim's words and yet maintain spiritual life, neither can we add, though the thing may be good, as we may see it. It would throw the word out of balance, and it would be Elohim's word no longer, just as the milk would be milk no longer. Elohim's word must be kept in the human heart, pure and unadulterated. If we must live by it, the robe woven in the loom of heaven has in it not one thread of human devising. That's taken from Christ's Object Lessons, page 311 by Ellen G. White. One may say, if milk is not balanced diet, it's not a balanced diet, how then can a babe be raised on the milk and yet be perfectly healthy? Elohim, who made the milk, knew what the baby requires for its growth and what the milk could supply, so he has made provision before the baby is born. Between the stomach and the small intestine, in that part of the bowel, is found a large lump. This lump is placed there to supply the iron. The opening into the small intestine, as well as to the stomach, is too small for the lump to pass through. Thus, it is compelled to remain there. Each time nourishment passes by, it absorbs part of the iron. Thus, the element is supplied, and the babe has suffered no lack. As the baby grows older, the lump gradually decreases in size, just as it is with the human babe, so it is with the animal life. Truly, our Elohim is infallible, and who can comprehend his wisdom? Why spend money for that which is not bread? Wherefore do you spend money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. Isaiah 55:2. When we spend our money for food which does not contain all the required element, or if it is of an unbalanced proportion, then it is not as the Creator made it. In such a case, we have spent our money for that which is not bread. When buying food, we must be very careful in our selection and make sure that it is free from adulteration nor disjunctive manufacturing processes. In such foods, the elements required to sustain physical health are not found. It would be only a waste of money in buying such food. The worst harm done by the use of these basal products is not to one's pocketbook only, but to his health and reducing his physical power. The upkeep of the human body depends on the food supply we give it. Medicine to Jews and Gentiles, blind watchman, Isaiah 56. So in the beginning of this chapter, Yahweh asks his people, keep your judgment and do justice. The reason given is that his salvation is near to come and his righteousness to be revealed. The thought is that the scroll is soon to make a turn, and the present order of things must change, that the watchman unto whom Elohim is speaking would not commence a general house cleaning. Elohim would have to get watchmen who would lift their voice like a trumpet and show his people their transgression in the house of Jacob, their sin. Elohim, in this chapter, asks his people for a strict Sabbath observance, regardless who they are, without distinction of class, race, or people. Thus they have the promise of his covenant, and their offerings and sacrifices shall be accepted upon his altar. There is a severe charge against his watchmen of their failure to deal with the sins in the church, and the result is that his people are devoured by the enemy. His watchmen are blind. They are all ignorant. They are all dumb dogs. They cannot bark. Isaiah 56:10. The phrase dumb dogs is not to humiliate them, but is used here as a symbol. Of all animals, a dog is man's best friend, and it is a dog's business to protect his master or warn him of the danger by the sounding of his barking. But if that dog becomes dumb and fails to give the sound, then he is not only useless unto his master but dangerous, for he cannot be depended upon. Thus the dog is a perfect symbol of a watchman over Yahweh's people. A good, faithful minister is man's best friend by warning him of the danger involved in sin, but if that minister will not sound the alarm and give the warning, then he has become as a dumb dog, not only useless but dangerous, for thus the sheep are devoured by the enemy. The watchmen are not only charged with failure to deal properly with the existing sins in the church, but they are greedy as well. Come ye, say they, I will fetch wine, and we will fill ourselves with strong drink. Isaiah 56:12. This refers to the same watchmen or servants as in Matthew 24:48-50, who are gluttonous, disregard health, reform, and do not see the danger. Read Isaiah the Gospel Prophet, page 25. First paragraph, the watchmen mentioned by the prophet are not those in Babylon, popular churches, but his watchmen in his true church, according unto the testimonies of ministers, page 445. Ezekiel 9 is the seating of the 144,000. Speaking of Ezekiel's prophecy, volume 5, page 211, we read, the ancient men, those unto whom Elohim had given great light and who had stood as guardians of the spiritual interests of the people, had betrayed their trust. They had taken the position that we need not look for miracles and the marked manifestation of Elohim's power as in former days. Times have changed. Those words strengthen their unbelief, and they say that Yahshua will not do good, neither will he do evil. He is too merciful to visit his people in the judgment. Thus peace and safety is the cry from men who will never again lift up their voices like a trumpet to show Elohim's people their transgressions and the house of Jacob their sin. These dumb dogs that would not bark are the ones who feel the just vengeance of an offended Elohim. Men, maidens, and little children all perish together. The righteous and the wicked in the day of trouble. The entire 57th chapter deals with the idolatry in Yahweh's church. Yahweh's people were called to come out of Babylon. The reason why we are called out is that we are to depart from the custom of Babylon. This chapter reveals the truth. Though we came out, we brought the customs and idolatry into the house of Elohim. The evil spoken of in this chapter is Christmas keeping and Christmas gifts one to another. The ninth verse says, we have honored the king, the devil, by doing this and debased ourselves even unto hell. This surely is true. We as a people spend the Yahshua's money in telling the public that Christmas is not the birthday of Yahshua, and then turn about and do the same thing the world is doing. By such methods, we are implicated in the highest form of hypocrisy. Isaiah 57:4-5. And 6. Tell of the evil practices of the Israel of old, and are written in this chapter to make a comparison with the people now, and as much as to say, we are doing the same as they back there, and are no better, quoting Volume 1, page 129. I saw that many who profess to believe the truth for these last days think it strange that the children of Israel murmured as they sojourned that after the wonderful dealings of Elohim with them, they should be so ungrateful as to forget what he had done for them, said the angel. You have done worse than they. To explain the entire chapter, it must be taken verse by verse, but being too lengthy, it cannot be done at this present time. So, next subtitle is True Fasting, the Sabbath Restored, Isaiah 58. And we are now at the end of our study this hour, so we're going to pick up on part number two of ushering in his everlasting kingdom. We're going to pick up with page 147, Shepherd Rod, Volume 1, and we're going to start with True Fasting, the Sabbath Restored, Isaiah 58. Because he lives, Yah sent his Son. They called him Yahshua. He came to love, heal, and forgive. He lived and died to banish pardon. An empty grave is there to prove my Savior lives. Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. Because I know he holds a future, and life is worth the living just because he lives. How sweet to hold a newborn baby and feel the pride and joy he gives. But greater still, the calm assurance this child can face uncertain days because he lives. Because he lives, I can face tomorrow. Because he lives, all fear is gone. Because I know he holds a future, and life is worth the living just because he lives. And then one day I'll cross your river, off my last heart, no more with pain. And then as dead, is went to victory. I see the lights of glory, and I'll know He lives. Because He lives, I can face tomorrow. Because He lives, I'll fear His God. Because I know He holds the future, and life is worth the living just because He lives.